From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Our guest, Barian Moore, says a nationwide tax on carbon emissions could be one way to address climate change.
And I think that's the kind of thing that we need to do. What we need to particularly do is saying that this is not a problem. It is a problem, but we ought to be grown up about it and face it.
But first, Joshua Landis joins me for an update on the Middle East, including the latest on the fight against ISIS in the Iraqi city of Mosul.
Nobody really knows what's going to happen to the city of a million people after. Is it going to make the situation worse, or is it going to make it better? And there isn't really a plan for the day after.
These conversations are coming up right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot. Joshua Landis, we have to do a Middle East update because obviously we've had some major military operations going on in Mosul, and we haven't heard from you since then. This has been highly controversial, obviously the U.S. in the middle of this. So tell us what's going on and how well things are working at this point.
Well, there's a real sense of urgency about defeating ISIS, if not totally taking down the capital in Iraq, which is Mosul. This is a major city of over a million people. It's the second largest city in Iraq. In 2014, ISIS swept in, took the city. 60,000 Christians were expelled in one day. They fled. And so did Yazidis and all the other minorities, Shiites and so forth. It's a Sunni city owned by ISIS. There are 40,000 Iraqi army surrounding the city now and closing in on it. There are also Shiite militias coming in from the west. And the United States, several thousand U.S. special forces with intelligence, Air Force, and there's believed to be about 5,000 ISIS inside the city. They're going to get destroyed. It's only a matter of time. The big anxiety is that ISIS has closed the city and trapped all of these civilians inside. So America is walking on eggshells, worried that it could lead to some kind of terrible slaughter, and it does not want that in the news.
Well, clearly that has been the big issue, right? As we've all been paying attention to the presidential election, this has been on the front pages about letting them know, telegraphing basically that we're going to attack Mosul so that these civilians can get out, I presume. But they can't because, as you said, they're basically being held captive. This is clearly the quintessential human shield that's happening here. So how is that likely to affect the operation then? Is it going to happen anyway? Is it just going to be
It's going to happen anyway. And we're going in. The other big question, of course, is what happens once we've captured the city? Because we have precedents. Ramadi, Tikrit, a bunch of other cities have been taken. And in those cities, there have been massive destruction of real estate. 80% of the housing stock in Ramadi was destroyed. And then rather sectarian Shiite militias came through, blew up a lot of extra houses because they were owned by ISIS people. There was revenge. And this has left a trail of tears behind it and a worse sectarian problem. And nobody really knows what's going to happen to the city of a million people after. Is it going to make the situation worse, or is it going to make it better? And there isn't really a plan for the day after.
So not only the plans for that city, but the plans for the next cities, the next ISIS locations, so Raqqa, other places. What's
Raqqa.
Going to happen there?
Well, this is – Mosul is the last big city in Iraq, and ISIS will be driven out of Iraq fairly rapidly after this falls. But then there's ISIS in Syria. The Iraqi militias have said, we're not going to stop at the Syrian border. We're going to keep on going. We're going to destroy ISIS. America wants to destroy them too. Secretary of Defense Carter said it's only a matter of weeks before we start attacking ISIS in Raqqa. Raqqa is the capital in Syria of ISIS. If that falls, then President Obama will have done what his generals say they were going to do before he leaves office, which is to destroy and take back these two cities. But Raqqa presents a whole different set of problems because we're at odds and daggers drawn with the Assad government.
So they take back the cities, but does this, and I'm going to air quote now, defeat ISIS? What does this do? What does this really do for ISIS in terms of you know, moving them out of these capitals, these big cities? But what's next?
Well, it denies them real estate. They've lost their caliphate. Their whole differentiation from al-Qaeda and everybody else is that we aren't going to pussyfoot around. We're taking this land. We're naming a caliphate. We're doing it. We're building a state. This defeats their state. Then they go back to being an insurgency. And there are tremendous concerns that they're going to attack Europe, they're going to attack America, that they're going to go abroad instead of trying to build their state.
So it just diffuses the problem rather than
it's not finished.
It there. All right, Joshua, thank you so much for being here. As
pleasure.
Always. We'd love it if you'd let us know what you thought about this conversation, and we're happy to try to answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org or send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. I'm on Twitter at Suzek Rolat. Coming up, I'll talk with Barrion Moore, who's the Chief Weather and Climate Officer at the University of Oklahoma. We'll talk about some of the international aspects of climate change and his involvement with last year's UN conference and the negotiation of the Paris Agreement. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Today, I'm joined by Barrion Moore. He's the University of Oklahoma's Vice President for Weather and Climate Programs, the Dean of the College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences, and the Director of the National Weather Center in Norman. Before he came to OU, he served as the founding executive director of a think tank that focused on climate change. He also spent nearly 40 years at the University of New Hampshire, and he specializes in the global carbon cycle and environmental and space policy. Barrion Moore, welcome to Worldviews.
Delighted to be here. Absolutely delighted.
Well, Barrion, I know you do a lot of work on climate issues. Climate change is obviously something we talk about a lot, but what are some of the specific things that we need to focus on? And in particular, I know you've been involved in the conference in Paris not too long ago. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the international governance issues involving climate change and atmospheric issues.
Well, it was fascinating. It began on November the 30th and went till December the 13th. And I found it particularly interesting in that the first week I saw what I expected, which was that the major countries started backing off and saying, well, we really can't hold to a 2-degree warming. We ought to maybe move that to about 3 degrees. And by Thursday of the first week, you sensed the backlash. And the developed world, the small countries, island states, start saying, wait a minute, 2 degrees is not going to meet our needs. We've got to hold it to 1.5. And the French, I think, handled it just beautifully in that they got people back on board and they started targeting what you could do. Could you get to 1.5? And took it as a real challenge. And I thought that at the end, it was quite successful. But I will say the goal is immensely ambitious. In fact, Chris Field, a dear friend of mine from Stanford, is just saying that the IPCC was looking at this, and he thinks it's just on the edge of doable. But if you say, well, we're going to try to do 2 degrees or as much under 2 degrees as we can, like 1.5, then that sets a very challenging target, but doable.
Well, so I want to get to this issue of some of the obstacles. Obviously, some of the, when you say major countries, you know, the more developed countries, those are actually emitting perhaps, but or at least major players in the world. So when you talk about, just to clarify, when you talk about trying to get to 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, obviously this is a reduction in kind of global average temperatures, I would presume. So in terms of getting there, that 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees, we're talking about reducing emissions in order to basically protect the Earth from warming,
right?
Because we're breaking down atmospheric protection from the sun, right? So this is basically what we're getting at, is that whole global warming issue, which then by extension leads to climate change and all of the various extremes,
right,
that we're perhaps even witnessing in temperatures, right? So that's the kind of clarification. So then the issue is those that are perhaps contributing more to this problem. Is that who you're talking about? The major countries that are contributing to this problem and the difficulty they're going to have in making those proper adjustments in emissions?
Well, we have to look at two things. One, we have to look at where the major contributions are today, because that's where we have to work from. But the fact that the carbon dioxide concentration of the atmosphere has increased from about 280 parts per million concentration in the pre-industrial times to now over 400. So it's about a 40% increase in the concentration of carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas. That really has been brought about by the total emissions that the United States, Europe, China, and so forth have done. So we have both the issue of kind of an equity question of well, those that have already emitted CO2, what about the developing countries that would like their shot at the carbon barrel, you might say? And unfortunately, we really have to reduce emissions. Yes, there have been those that came first, but now we have to reduce emission in order to stabilize the concentration in the atmosphere. And that's the key thing. It's the concentration in the atmosphere. To stabilize it, you've got to cut emissions by about 80%.
But that's an 80% cut in emissions total, right? And as you mentioned, the total barrel. So each of these governments then, major players, need to go home and create legislation, regulations, things that will control the emissions that are coming from their country, from their specific
That's
countries,
right.
the industries and such that are coming, you know, that are operating in their specific countries. So I presume there's some sort of rather complicated negotiation process to have a certain part of that barrel, that overall emissions, and who's going to have to reduce more, right? I would presume that's maybe the stickiest
that
point.
That is the sticky issue. And what came out of Paris was a set of voluntary targets. Unfortunately, if you took all of the voluntary targets and put them up and say, okay, that's what we're going to do, you're off by about a factor of three. So you have to go from the voluntary targets that came out of Paris and go further down. And that will be challenging. But I think it's doable. It's technologically doable. It's just difficult.
So it's a matter of politically doable, right? The political will to do it. And then, of course, the role of private enterprise, corporations, industries, those that are actually going to have to implement these sorts of reductions. I mean, this could be costly for some, right? So, I mean, let's leave the technologically doable thing aside because we know that's the case. How are you going to get to the political will? What mechanisms are there in an international political environment such as we have to regulate this and hold people accountable and enforce some sort of global agreement of this sort?
I think right now it's a question of an informed politic, and we need to get away from the kind of the blame game. I think we need to get away from denialism and really speak to the body politic. Quite frankly, in the United States, about two-thirds of the people believe it's a human-caused problem, and so really there is the building of the political will. And I think that we just have to accept that energy is going to be more expensive. But after all, the color of money is green. And so there can be real businesses formed around these new enterprises. Look at the wind power industry here in Oklahoma. I mean, it's a very strong, fast-growing industry. In terms of new capacity for electricity, wind is number one.
This seems to be the potential solution to all of this, right, is that you monetize and you create business and industry around environmental. I mean, we've already seen this happening. You mentioned wind, and there are multiple other examples we can probably make along this way. But it is more costly. It is perhaps more expensive. But there's money to be made by being environmentally sustainable and responsible. But, you know, how do we encourage that, I guess, if it's going to be a market solution as well as, you know, government and a regulation, there'll be solutions that are government oriented and regulatory. How do we facilitate the business side of things?
Well, I think there's one thing that you could do, but it is going to be controversial, and that is a carbon tax. We use taxes all the time to push behavior one way or the other. We use taxes to pay for things like roads when you buy gasoline. And so you could have a carbon tax, and that's a relatively easy thing to install. We know what the carbon concentration in terms of an industry, in terms of making things. And so I think that that's a doable tax. And then you would have to get by the political will. And you could say, well, let's make it revenue neutral. And so all you're really doing is just shifting. So you could have maybe a reduction in income taxes that would be matched by the carbon tax. But the carbon tax would drive industries towards low carbon solutions because there'd be a price advantage. And I think that's the kind of thing that we need to do. What we need to particularly do is saying that this is not a problem. It is a problem, but we ought to be grown up about it and face it.
That's Berrien Moore, the Vice President of Weather and Climate Programs at the University of Oklahoma. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzek Rilat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rilat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Let's get back to my conversation with my colleague, Berrien Moore, who's the Dean of OU's College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences. He's also the Director of the National Weather Center in Norman and OU's Vice President for Weather and Climate Programs. We've been talking about some of the international implications of climate change and his work with the 2015 Climate Conference in Paris.
You mentioned earlier that we need to get away from denialism and that we need to focus on an informed political body. But, I mean, that raises this issue of education and obviously raising awareness about these issues. But we've already seen that there are those deniers or are those that push back on this notion that it is human responsibility that our planet is warming and that we're having these sorts of consequences. So just education alone, given the fact that we have a political environment where people deny the scientific facts of the matter, whether it's human-made or not, the facts are the facts, right? And so how do you fight that battle politically rather than scientifically?
I don't think you have to win 100%. As I say, already you have a majority of people that kind of recognize the problem. After all, the European Center for Medium Range Forecasting, ECMWF, and we praise their weather model all the time. In fact, the United States Air Force has adopted their weather model. They got Superstorm Sandy correct. Well, that's the same model they use for climate work. And so we can't say, well, that's a really good weather forecast, and it does very well, and then say, oh, but with this climate business, that's completely different. Same physics. Same chemistry.
So making that connection more clear between
right.
the climate issue and the weather modeling issue and how climate affects our weather. So let's talk about weather for a second, because you're
sure.
kind of like the chief meteorologist, I guess, over there, right? The National Weather Center. So tell us about what we're to expect with weather, because obviously there's been a lot of assumptions over the years that global warming means it's just going to get hotter and hotter, but that isn't necessarily the case. It's just more volatile in terms of our weather patterns. Some places will be hotter, other places it'll be colder, there'll be more hurricanes, more unstable weather. What are we to
well,
expect?
Well, some of what you say is true, and some of what you say is we don't know. And more hurricanes, possibly. More tornadic activity, I don't think we know. The difficulty is when I start making statements about extreme events are extremely unlikely. That's why they're called extreme events. And now you have to say something about the average, and now you're going to say how it's going to affect the extreme events. That's tough. But there are certain things that are very clear. Sea surface temperatures are rising. Sea surface levels are rising. You're not allowed to talk about global warming in Florida, but they now talk about inconvenient flooding in Miami because of sea level rise. And I think that as these things become clear, then we will begin to kind of recognize our role in this. And then I think business will recognize opportunities. But, you know, returning to the weather question, I think one of the very interesting things is that we have done a terrific job over the last, say, 10 or 15 years in increasing lead times for tornadic forecasts. And we've done really tremendously well there. However, we've not cut death rates. And so we actually have a social dimension to this important problem, more or less like the climate question. And it's not so much the physics and the technology, it really is a social question. And we're seeing the same thing with tornadic behavior. You know, we had this terrible event a couple of years ago on a Friday when, unfortunately, people were told, get out of town. Well, now you already have traffic jams on 44 and I-35 in Oklahoma City. And it's a Friday afternoon, and now you've told everyone to get out of town. And yet you had tornadic conditions bearing down upon now highly exposed people.
So when the social dimension, though, just be clear. So obviously the how we communicate information about what we're seeing, what we're forecasting, what, you know, that we can tell when a tornado is coming at you, right? And when hurricanes are coming at you, we have a tremendous ability to do that. But how we communicate it and how it's how it's received, right, by those watching the weather reports or watching as that hurricane is coming toward us, in terms of how they respond, what it is that they do in response to that information. Again, goes back to this issue of education and awareness and making sure that people are aware. So that's really what you're talking about in terms of the social dimension, is that communication, education, awareness, and then, you know, informed response.
And I think the response needs to have been thought through. This is an area where families ought to have conversations, so that they not really do a dress rehearsal, but they at least think it through.
You do fire drills, you do tornado drills.
Exactly.
You do, yeah.
And we do the same thing. I mean, the football team does the same thing. They think about, well, in this situation, we'll do thus and so. And in this situation, our opponent may do thus and so, and therefore we need to be ready and we need to do certain things. And that's talked about.
So you need a playbook.
That's right.
You need to have a playbook.
And you ought to have a playbook. And that it varies. Is if it's on a weekend, we ought to do this. And if, but that way, you're thinking it through, so that when you then get warnings, that you've already thought this thing through, and you don't do something foolish that puts you in harm's way. And I think that really speaks to a lot of aspects of education in a way.
But in so many ways, weather's a spectator sport too, right? I mean, I remember I grew up in Oklahoma. My mother would stand on the front porch when a tornado was coming, you know, watching the skies. So, you know, that's what we do, is we chase storms. We go out and we watch these things.
And I think that's all right up to a point. And then you need to be very thoughtful. We've already seen some very tragic situations with storm chasers. We had that deaths a couple of years ago in that severe outbreak. And we just have to be smart. We put students and faculty into the field with radar trucks doing scientific investigations, but we know when to back out.
Well, it sounds like when it comes to the climate, environment, weather, all of it, it's all related, and we all need to be smart about it. So
that's right.
Thank you so much, Barrion, for being here today. It's really great to get your perspective.
It's wonderful and honor to be on this program.
You've been listening to my conversation with Barrion Moore, who spent more than 50 years studying weather, climate change, and space policy. There's more information online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski records and edits our interviews. Sam Dupre produces the show. Our research assistant is Katie Holland, and our digital content intern is Audra Bruhls. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.